Today is Thursday, September 24th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. World leaders used their time during the UNGA to call for fair distribution of a future COVID-19 vaccine.
If the answer to this pandemic lies in finding a vaccine, that vaccine should be made available to the whole world.
Plus, cybersecurity at the virtual meeting.
You're talking about an organization that many, many different hostile actors stand to benefit by either gaining inside information about what the UN is doing or by altering that information.
We'll have these stories and more next. Heads of state are urging the international community to make a COVID-19 vaccine available to the whole world once one is developed. Several leaders made the plea during their pre-recorded messages during day two of the annual United Nations Gathering of World Leaders. Here's just a small sample of the leaders from Ghana, Kazakhstan, and Palau.
If the answer to this pandemic lies in finding a vaccine, that vaccine should be made available to the whole world, rich and poor alike, developed and developing, all races and all beliefs. The virus has taught us that we are all at risk and there's no special protection for the rich or a particular class.
COVID-19 has exposed our past mistakes and failures. We have witnessed a critical collapse of global cooperation in response to this crisis. Trade protectionism and political nationalism coming close to what some have already called a state of global dysfunction. The whole world is on the verge of dramatic upheavals that may lead to irreversible consequences.
We know that this pandemic is far from over, and small states cannot also be left out in the race to seek an effective vaccine. In a global community, parts of the world cannot be made safe in isolation. Vaccine hoarding will harm us all. Palau's recovery from the economic crisis of COVID will not be possible without sharing in this process to develop a vaccine.
Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, says that while it is crucial to continue working toward closing the global digital gap, leaders need to balance that work by fighting misinformation and violent extremism and terrorism online.
We need to secure a free, open and secure internet, but we also need to acknowledge that some of the new technologies we're seeing on the world stage also, if misused, can be a place to promote violent extremism and harm.
In a pre-recorded video during a panel discussion on global digital cooperation, Ardern said the mass shootings at two New Zealand mosques on March 15, 2019, where a white supremacist killed 51 worshippers, prompted her to work alongside French President Emmanuel Macron to develop what she called the Christchurch Call.
We need to look at the problems of exploitation online for children, the use of the internet for disinformation and misinformation, cyber attacks and the real world harm that they cause, and of course, cybercrime.
She advocated for collaborative work to ensure that the world rids itself of some of the things that undermine the benefits of digital technology. And on that note, Aaron Fedor has this story about the challenges and security risks of holding the UNGA online this year.
The 75th session of the annual United Nations General Assembly meeting is underway, but this year, world leaders are not at the UN headquarters in New York. They're staying away because of the coronavirus pandemic and instead delivering speeches via pre-taped video and holding important meetings online.
This is all new to us. The idea of going to a virtual format is relatively new to the United Nations, just like it is to the rest of the world. We've been working on our procedures since March, so they keep getting better as people start to become more familiar with the technology.
But the virtual formats are leaving the UN and other organizations open to cybersecurity threats. The widespread shift to virtual platforms has resulted in a 700% increase in cyber breaches this year alone, experts say. Schools, businesses, and organizations are all vulnerable to so-called Zoom bombing interruptions when hackers break into video conference calls. The door is also open to more dangerous intrusions.
When it comes to organizations like the United Nations, again, you're talking about an organization that many, many different hostile actors stand to benefit by either gaining inside information about what the UN is doing, or by altering that information, or by changing that agenda.
Ransomware attacks have risen 41% in 2019, according to security firm Emisoft. In such attacks, hackers are able to hold a person or organization's data hostage, demanding ransom money to allow the users to regain access. The U.S. cities Atlanta, Baltimore, and Albany have all been targeted in the past. The UN faces potential ransomware attacks and the threat of hackers breaking into computer systems to steal video files and transcripts.
You may also see people looking to repurpose the video for disinformation reasons. You see people sort of editing video these days and trying to use it for whatever their political agenda is. And sort of given the range of hot button issues that the UN is dealing with, I would also be on the lookout for, you know, maybe a rise and disinformation use as well.
But who would conduct such attacks and why?
So I don't think you're going to see ISIS or Al-Qaeda trying to use the internet to sabotage the UN, but there are a variety of either state sponsors or state-sponsored actors or state actors from a variety of different nations that may seek to gain the upper hand or leverage in terms of activities at the UN by either gaining inside knowledge or by altering the course of events through what is going on online.
Brendan Varma says the UN will evaluate how the pandemic and technology develop before deciding whether next year's General Assembly will meet in person or online.
We will make calls based on what works for the United Nations and for the peoples of the world.
But for now, they are working on keeping this year's session safe. Aaron Fedor for VOA News, New York.
In his video address to the United Nations General Assembly, U.S. President Donald Trump praised the United States' role in brokering two peace agreements between Israel and two Arab states, but stopped short of calling Palestinians and Israelis to resume talks. The leaders of France, Jordan, and Egypt expressed in their speeches a different approach to peace based on a two-state solution. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy has more.
The decades-long conflict between Palestinians and Israelis is rooted in the dispute over land with great religious and historical significance to Christians, Muslims, and Jews. Multiple U.S. administrations have sought to broker a lasting peace that would result in two states on the disputed land. President Donald Trump introduced a new vision that promised some $50 billion worth of investment in a developing Palestinian state, but it also suggests that the Palestinian territory in the West Bank would shrink by about 30% as Israel annexes the Jordan Valley and its settlements there. Palestinian leaders have rejected the plan, saying it deprives the Palestinians of their rights to self-determination and independence in their own state. In his address to the United Nations General Assembly on Tuesday, President Trump celebrated his role as a peace broker, but did not mention the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
We reached a landmark breakthrough with two peace deals in the Middle East after decades of no progress. Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain all signed a historic peace agreement in the White House with many other Middle Eastern countries to come.
Trump told the General Assembly that his untraditional approach in the Middle East made him hopeful about a bright future for the region with no blood on the sand. However, in his address to the General Assembly, Jordanian King Abdullah emphasized that the only way to end the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is the two-state solution in accordance with international law and UN resolutions. Jordan is a close U.S. ally and signed a peace treaty with Israel in 1994.
The only way towards just and lasting peace must lead to an independent, sovereign, and viable Palestinian state on the June 4, 1967 lines with East Jerusalem as its capital, living side by side with Israel in mutual peace and security.
King Abdullah hinted at rejecting Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as a unified capital of Israel. He said, "The conflict cannot be solved without working to preserve Jerusalem for all humanity as a unifying city of peace." Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi told the assembly that the international community has an obligation to honor its commitment to achieving peace and to prevent measures that undermine the prospects of the two-state solution. He reminded listeners that the two-state solution is stipulated in UN resolutions as the basis for Middle East peace process.
ولا سبيل للتخلص من هذا العبء وفتح آفاق السلام والتعاون والعيش.
Sisi says that to keep the prospect of peace alive, the UN must fulfill the legitimate aspirations of the Palestinian people for an independent state with East Jerusalem as its capital. Egypt, another U.S. ally, signed the first Arab peace treaty with Israel in 1979. French President Emmanuel Macron used his address to criticize the Trump administration's approach to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. He said he doesn't believe in peace that would be built on hegemony or humiliation or even compensated by money. He called for decisive negotiations that would allow Palestinians to enjoy their rights while respecting the security and sovereignty of both sides. Some analysts in the U.S. have said the agreements between Israel, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates may be linked to those countries' shared concern about Iran, and they say it could pave the way for an eventual relationship between Saudi Arabia and Israel. The United Nations Special Coordinator for the Middle East, Nikolai Mladenov, last month said the agreement between Bahrain and Israel could encourage leaders from the region to engage in meaningful negotiations to end the conflict. But he also said that a two-state solution is the only path forward. Mohammed Al-Shinawi, VOA News, Washington.
The United States Supreme Court's eight remaining justices gathered to pay their respects to their colleague, the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. AP correspondent Mike Hempen has more.
The justices appeared together at the Supreme Court for the first time since the building closed in March. Chief Justice John Roberts spoke during a private ceremony in the Great Hall.
Among the words that best describe Ruth, tough, brave, a fighter, a winner, but also thoughtful, careful, compassionate, honest.
Roberts says Ginsburg's opinions and dissents will steer the court for decades.
They are written with the unaffected grace of precision.
Ginsburg died Friday at the age of 87. She will lie in repose at the court for 2 days before her casket is moved to the Capitol. Mike Hemp in Washington.
Speaking to reporters Wednesday evening, U.S. President Donald Trump discussed his forthcoming nominee.
We are going to be having a very exciting Saturday at 5 o'clock in the Rose Garden, where I'll be putting forth my nominee for Supreme Court Justice. And I think it will be a great nominee, a brilliant nominee. As you know, it's a woman. We brought it down to five women.
Kentucky's black state attorney general choked up when answering questions at a news conference Wednesday about why no police officers were facing criminal charges in Breonna Taylor's death.
Certainly understand the pain that has been brought about by the tragic loss of Ms. Taylor. I understand that as a attorney general who is responsible for all 120 counties in terms of being the chief legal officer, the chief law enforcement officer. I understand that. I understand that as a black man, how painful this is. And which is why it was so incredibly important for make sure that we did everything we possibly could to uncover every fact. And I know, this team, myself, the members of the representatives of the Attorney General's office have taken a lot of criticism and scrutiny. But that scrutiny in many ways was misplaced because there was not a day the people in this office didn't go to sleep thinking about this case, and it wasn't a day where the first thing on our minds is getting to the truth in this case. And obviously, again, the criminal law is not meant to respond to every sorrow and grief. And that is true here. But my heart breaks for the loss of Ms. Taylor. And I've said that repeatedly. My mother, if something was to happen to me, would find it very hard. And I've seen that pain on Ms. Palmer's face. I've seen that pain in the community.
A grand jury has indicted a fired Kentucky police officer on criminal charges in the Breonna Taylor case, but not for her death. Brett Hawkinson was charged Wednesday with 3 counts of wanton endangerment for firing into the apartments of Taylor's neighbors. Taylor was shot multiple times by officers who burst into her home on March 13th during a narcotics investigation. Coming up later in today's program,
our comprehensive analysis of the 223 cases that we investigated, complemented by a legal analysis, gives us reason to believe that those violations were perpetrated as part of a widespread systematic policy.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Caltech astronomers generated excitement in 2016 when they found evidence of a giant planet they called Planet Nine in the far reaches of the solar system. While Planet Nine has yet to be seen or imaged, evidence of its existence was gathered through observations of the odd orbital behavior of several Kuiper Belt objects. In October 2019, a new theory emerged that Planet Nine is not a planet, but actually a small-sized primordial black hole, or a black hole that had formed shortly after the Big Bang. Scientists at Harvard University and the Black Hole Initiative plan to determine whether the mystery object is or is not a black hole with their newly developed method of finding black holes in the outer solar system. The scientists plan to use their new way of spotting black holes at a new observatory that's being built in northern Chile. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. With October just around the corner, 2020 is set to enter its waning quarter, and as world leaders gather virtually in New York for this year's UN General Assembly to discuss what they feel are the most pressing issues facing the globe, what do analysts see as the greatest geopolitical issues following the 2020 U.S. election? Roger Baker, Senior Vice President for Strategic Analysis at Stratfor, a RAIN company, discussed with me what a Trump or Biden victory in November might mean for interactions with China.
Clearly, the question of global trade and China's role in global trade in the next 2 or 3 quarters, the idea of vaccine nationalism and the response to COVID, and the continued expansion of China's assertion of its strategic position and its near abroad and its alternate to global norms and standards on the international stage.
What do you see as possible interactions with the United States and Beijing, either similarly or differently, depending on who wins the White House in November?
Well, this becomes the real big space for difference. On the one hand, there's not going to be a diminution of the perception that China is the core strategic competitor to the United States. That crosses the aisle, and that's across the board, everything from military and security through technology and economics down to questions of human rights and the concepts of freedom of economics and the like. But what we see is that if the Democrats should win the election, they are more likely to take those issues and combine them into a single coordinated campaign and relationship with China. And that in some ways will actually complicate things. If you look at the competition between the U.S. and China over the last 4 years, the transactional nature of this administration has allowed different aspects of the competition to go unconnected. So the phase one trade deal is still in place. even as the U.S. is putting some sanctions or restrictions on Hong Kong and increasing its military position in the South China Sea.
You know, speaking of the South China Sea, Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte actually spent part of his UN virtual address bringing up that 2016 Court of Arbitration ruling that said the nine-dash line held no water. So with so much time having gone past without really bringing that up to Beijing and Beijing telling the world that they were not going to abide by it, what does that do moving forward?
Well, it's been interesting to watch the Philippines. So when Duterte came into power, he said he wasn't going to pursue that claim, the Court of Arbitration mm-hmm. ruling, because the Philippines was not strong enough. He said he was going to work closer with China because the United States had not prevented China from taking the islands. And he had expected that, and he said that the economic cost of not working with China was too great compared to the lack of benefit of working with the United States, which neither brought economic benefits, nor did it protect the islands. Over the last several months in particular, we have seen a large push from the Duterte administration, not from Duterte himself, but from the rest of his cabinet, really countering that narrative that he had been playing and his more cooperative relationship with the Chinese. And this seems to be him being pulled and teased back in line with his own cabinet now in seeing that, one, the economic benefits have not come through. Two, the United States, with Pompeo and the other three administration officials who did their series of speeches on China, have finally come out with really clear statements on how the U.S. views Chinese claims in the South China Sea. And so this is, I think, the Philippines testing the United States on that. Is the United States really going to stand up and counter what they see as illegitimate Chinese claims?
That was Senior Vice President for Strategic Analysis at the RAIN Company, Stratfor, Roger Baker. North Korea is preparing to hold a major military parade next month. Some analysts expect Pyongyang may unveil new major weapons. VOA's Bill Gallo has the latest indications about what those weapons may be.
October 10th is a major holiday in North Korea. It's the 75th anniversary of the ruling Workers' Party. And North Korea is apparently planning a big parade. Commercial satellite photos suggest the North has been rehearsing for weeks at a parade training facility outside the capital. On Tuesday, the website 38 North said part of those preparations appear to involve a missile-related vehicle. The organization does not know for sure what the vehicle is, but says it appears to be large enough to fit an intercontinental ballistic missile, meaning it could be an ICBM mobile launcher. Some analysts predict North Korea may unveil a new solid-fuel ICBM at the parade. Others say Pyongyang could soon showcase a submarine-launched ballistic missile. Either would add an unpredictable new component to North Korea's arsenal. Solid fuel missiles are easier to transport and take less time to prepare for launch. Submarine launch missiles are also mobile and easier to hide. A major display of military power could be seen as a provocation just weeks ahead of the U.S. presidential election. U.S. President Donald Trump says he has no problem with North Korea's short-range launches, but he may object to a bigger move. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
A United Nations investigation into Venezuela's human rights record has uncovered gross violations and abuse ordered and committed at the highest levels of the government of President Nicolas Maduro, accusations angrily dismissed by Venezuelan authorities. The report by the Independent International Fact-Finding Mission on Venezuela has been submitted to the UN Human Rights Council. Lisa Schlein has the details.
The UN investigators say they regret the lack of cooperation from the Venezuelan government. Since they were not allowed to enter the country, they interviewed victims and witnesses inside Venezuela using remote technological means. Nevertheless, they say they have been able to collect an abundance of material and evidence showing grave violations have been perpetrated directly by members of state security forces and by civil and military intelligence services. Chair of the fact-finding mission, Marta Valinas, says violations include extrajudicial executions committed in the context of security operations, arbitrary detentions, torture, and acts of sexual violence against people who disagree with or oppose the government. She speaks through an interpreter.
Our comprehensive analysis of the 223 cases that we investigated, complemented by a legal analysis, gives us reason to believe that those violations were perpetrated as part of a widespread systematic policy and in line with state policy, and which, for that reason, are tantamount to crimes against humanity.
Venezuela's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Jorge Valero, views these findings with contempt. He accuses the United States of trying to overthrow his government. He refers to the so-called Operation Gideon, in which a private U.S.-based security firm led by a former U.S. Army Green Beret and Venezuelan expatriates led an aborted effort to capture President Nicolas Maduro. The United States has flatly denied any involvement. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said, if we had been involved, it would have gone differently. And U.S. President Donald Trump said, it has nothing to do with our government. Ambassador Valero criticizes the council by saying it is supposed to ensure universality, objectivity, and non-selectivity. But he says it has failed in this task. He speaks through an interpreter.
The office has spent around $3 million to draft the report. The CIA and other U.S. government bodies have poured millions into these international efforts. They use NGOs which have converted human rights into a profitable business.
The fact-finding mission says it stands by its report. It says it is crucial to investigate and prosecute those responsible for crimes, and above all, to provide justice for the victims. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
As rescuers try to free a pod of around 470 stranded whales off the Australian island of Tasmania, scientists puzzle over the cause of the mysterious phenomenon. Reuters' Megan Revell reports.
Whale beachings are a mystery. One of the world's largest known strandings off the coast of Tasmania has shone a new light on the phenomenon. The question of why beachings occur has puzzled marine biologists for years. While no one claims to know the exact reason, it's thought the answer may lie in the animal's character. Whales are very sociable, as are dolphins, who are also prone to mass beaching. They travel together in pods, often following a leader, and are known to gather around injured or distressed members. Strandings could be a simple case of misadventure. One or two get into trouble and the rest follow. Another theory relates to electromagnetic fields. Pilot whales use sophisticated sonar for orientation, which can be disrupted by solar storms or earthquakes. Some scientists say connections can even be found between naval sonar and strandings. Rescues are laborious, difficult, and often dangerous. Several people are needed per whale to try and push them back into deeper water at high tide. Rescuers try and keep the whales upright to avoid disorientation. Harnesses and stretchers are often used, and even boats to drag them out to sea. Sometimes there's nothing to be done. Wildlife biologist Chris Carlian is working on the Tasmania rescue.
Euthanasia is always an option that we have up our sleeve. It's not a simple practice, so particularly when we've got animals that remain semi-buoyant. We're not at a stage where we're considering euthanasia at this stage. The animals that are still alive, we think we do have a chance with those, given that they're wet, they're cool at this stage, and we're pushing ahead with rescue at this stage. But it is something that we always have in the back of our mind and can use if needed.
New Zealand and neighbouring Australia are beaching hotspots due to large colonies in the deep surrounding oceans. The largest stranding in recorded history was over 1,000 whales in 1918 on the shores of the Chatham Islands in the Pacific Ocean. Pilot whales are regularly trapped in Farewell Spit, a narrow sandbar that stretches out from New Zealand's South Island. About 600 pilot whales beached there in 2017. Cape Cod in Massachusetts is another global hotspot. It averages more than 200 stranded whales or dolphins each year.
That was Reuters reporter Megan Revell. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.